This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now for a little story. Once upon a time, the only planets we knew about were the ones in our own solar system. But as telescopes and techniques improved, we began to realize that there are plenty of planets to go around, that a solar system having planets may be the rule, not the exception. And in recent years, spurred on by even better instruments and improved hunting methods, astronomers are logging an increasing list of planets that could be sort of like home. The right general size, the right distance from this star, the Goldilocks zone. Well, this week astronomers announced the discovery of an intriguing new near neighbor, and here to talk about that and other selected short subjects in science is Rachel Feltman, editor of the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog. Always good to see you, Rachel.
Good to see you too,
Ira. Hope I didn't scare you away with that bedtime story.
No, not at all.
Well, let's talk about the discovery this week of this new exoplanet that could be sort of like Earth.
It could be sort of, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. It's called Proxima B, and it orbits Proxima Centauri, which is our closest star. It's a tiny little cool red dwarf about 4.25 light years away, which relatively speaking is, you know, a stone's throw. Mm-hmm. It could potentially be Earth-like. But there are a lot of things we don't know about this planet. In fact, all we do know about it is that it very likely exists. We know that it could be rocky based on how far it is from its star and what we know about the planets that form around red dwarf stars. We know that it could be in the star's habitable zone. But without an atmosphere, its temperature is around minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. It's only with an atmosphere that it would have temperatures similar to Earth. So there are all these ifs, you know, if it's actually
rocky. You're
spoiling
the story, Rich.
But it's still really cool because it's so close by. And, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear that there are probably planets around most stars. And even these red dwarf stars that were so neglected are good places to look for life.
You know, this got a lot of press this week,
right?
I think, as we used to say in the business. But I thought the really more interesting story was the scientists have found a galaxy that is almost 100% dark matter.
Right. So most galaxies like the Milky Way, which is kind of an average size galaxy, are about 90% dark matter. And scientists found one that is 99.99% dark matter, which basically means that it's as if somebody went into the Milky Way and for every 100 stars threw away 99 of them, but somehow it's staying together. You know, the gravitational forces of these stars should not be enough to keep the galaxy from tearing itself apart, and yet something keeps it together, and that thing is dark matter, and it makes up most of the galaxy.
Now, I know in a regular galaxy, you look at the bright stuff, and you say there's not enough of the bright stuff there mm-hmm. to keep it together.
So right.
There must, but a dark matter, which is all a galaxy that's all dark matter, how do you know it's even there?
Well, what's really cool is that they found it with this telescope called the Dragonfly that is basically a bunch of telephoto lenses stuck together because the researchers who built it realized that these objects that are really faint and big that are mm-hmm. hard to look at with traditional telescopes, that telephoto lenses like the ones you use at sporting events are actually pretty well suited for seeing these kinds of objects. So they just kind of put enough of the pieces together to turn it into a telescope. And while they were looking at the sky, they saw what they thought were image defects, these smudges. And once they re-examined the data and looked at them again with Keck, it turns out it's what they think is an entirely new class of object. And they think they're going to find a bunch more of these super dark galaxies.
Shades of Bell Labs and cosmic background radiation.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something wrong with the instrument, right? Let's talk about NASA just found a spacecraft that's been lost for 2 years.
Yeah. So, you know, it was
only...
How
do you lose a spacecraft?
Well, it was so recently that we said our final goodbyes to the Philae lander off of the Rosetta orbiter. You know, we had to finally deal with the fact that that lander was gone forever. And, you know, now NASA has a story with a potentially happier ending for Stereo B. It's one of two orbiters. They're on either side of the Earth orbiting the sun, and they create these 3D images of solar flares and coronal mass ejections so that scientists can better understand them. And basically what happened is that these outlived their lifespans by several years. And so scientists had to start to prepare for an event that the spacecraft hadn't been designed for, which was the spacecraft going behind the sun and mm-hmm. them not being able to communicate with it and it having to take care of itself. So they were trying to keep it from turning itself off in a way that would hurt it. And instead, they triggered it doing exactly that thing. So it let out a weak signal and then they didn't hear from it again. Then they knew it was going to be behind the sun anyway. Yeah. It was tumbling out of control. Its solar panels probably weren't getting light. But they finally caught it with enough power that it sent a signal back to the Deep Space Network 2 years later. The problem is that apparently they only have these really brief windows, like a few minutes at a time, where they can hope to reestablish communication and send it commands before it triggers the whole process again and does another hard reset and sends itself spiraling again. So it's not actually clear whether they're going to be able to regain control of it, but at least they know that it's out there.
That's a really fun story. And last, researchers are asking a 5,000-year-old man the "Who are you wearing?" fashion question. And they're getting, he's wearing a lot, isn't he?
Yeah, he's wearing an awful lot. Otzi the Iceman, who was found in 1991, is still giving us all this new information because we keep getting better and better techniques to examine him with. And researchers just used mitochondrial DNA sequencing on the clothes he's wearing because it's clear they're animal skins, but we had no way of telling which. And it turns out he is wearing at least 5 different species of animal. He is wearing goatskin leggings, a sheep loincloth. His shoes were made of cow leather. His hat was made out of a brown bear. His coat was made out of goats and sheep, at least like 4 different individual goats and sheep, I think. And then his arrow quiver was made from a deer. So he got around, clearly.
Wow, he's sort of the MacGyver of of Iceman.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because, you know, it raises the question of, you know, how many of these animals were domesticated? Yeah. Did he hunt them? Did he trade for them? Did he make the clothing himself? But, you know, we at least have this glimpse now into the fashion sense of a 5,300-year-old man.
Yeah. Rachel, always fascinating.
Thank you.
Thanks for dropping by, Rachel
thanks
Feldman.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. As editor of the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. The National Park Service celebrated its 100th birthday yesterday. Happy birthday. And this week, President Obama added to that list of protected parks and monuments. He quadrupled the size of a marine park in Hawaii and designated the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument in Maine. And if you're Maine, you go in Maine, you know what Katahdin is. More than 300 million tourists visited the parks in 2015, and that is a 5% increase from the previous year. And Grand Canyon National Park alone hosted 5.5 million visitors at the Grand Canyon. An increase in visitors also means, of course, more interest in development around the park. People want to develop Grand Canyon. Here to bring the good and the bad that could come with the development at the canyon is Roger Clark, Grand Canyon Program Director at the Grand Canyon Trust in Flagstaff, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ariel.
So what is the good news about development projects that want to bring more people and visitors to the Grand Canyon?
Well, certainly the economy is booming around tourism, and the canyon itself accounts for between $500 million and $1 billion a year in revenues that's spread throughout the regional economy and elsewhere. So it's good for business. I think it's good for people in general to be able to come to, particularly to Grand Canyon, to get out of their self-centeredness and breathe and take a look at you know, just the majesty of time. It's good to get out of your own self. And then I think it's good also in a way that the Park Service is trying to manage it at the park. By and large, they're doing a good job, but they have this competing mandate to both protect the park and allow for use and enjoyment. And at times, they don't always get it right. But again, I think it's because so much of the use is concentrated in less than 10% of the park. Mm-hmm. That's where most of the impact is. Of course, that creates congestion there. But that means much of the park is still available to explore on foot and to really experience the natural wonders and solitude and quiet of the park.
On the other hand, now, there is a proposal called the Escalade that would build a tram to the bottom of the canyon. People really want to build. Tell me what that plan is.
Well, you know, anytime something's this popular, people are going to want to try and make money on it. And this is another example of a idea to construct a tram from the eastern rim of the Grand Canyon on the Navajo Reservation down to the confluence of the Colorado River and Little Colorado River. So that would move about 10,000 people a day down to Riverside in the bottom of the canyon. And it would, I'm sure, be a profit maker and be very popular. But there's a danger of killing the golden goose. To take a very remote and completely undeveloped section of the canyon, which is very important to the Native American cultures around the canyon for many reasons, to develop that. So that's something that would penetrate into the park itself, and if it ever gets further than the proposal stage, would most surely wind up in court.
Does that involve building hotels and things for all the people?
Sort of like
turning it into a theme park.
Well, yeah. You know, you have to understand the Grand Canyon is like a desert island, and for this to be built, it would require roads, electrical lines, water, sewage, the whole gamut of what it takes to manage that many people a day. It would require lots of thinking ahead. That many people produce a lot of poop.
Yeah.
And I haven't figured that out.
I get it. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. Happy birthday to you, Roger.
Thank you.
Happy birthday to everybody in the National Park land. Roger Clark, Grand Canyon Program Director at the Grand Canyon Trust in Flagstaff, Arizona. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about teaching math in school. It's our back-to-school edition. What do you think about teaching math? How should it be taught differently? Should we do away with calculus, which people talk about? 844-724-8255 is our number. If you're a math teacher, you're just interested in math, give us a call or tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Did you use a polynomial equation today? What was the last time you calculated the area of a rotating trapezoid? It's a common complaint you hear from students. When are we ever going to use this type of math out in the real world? But in recent years, with failure rates on math on the rise, even educators are starting to ask these questions. Should we change the way math is taught, or even get rid of some of it altogether? Pre-calculus would get my vote. Joining me to discuss are my guests, Andrew Hacker, author of The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions, Maria Druzkova, a mathematician and founder of the company Natural Math, based out of Raleigh, North Carolina, Pamela Weber-Harris, lecturer at the University of Texas at Austin, author of Building Powerful Numeracy. Welcome to Science Friday. Andrew, let me start off with you. In what way is our math education system broken?
We hear on all sides that we're not teaching enough mathematics. You know, the Chinese are running rings around us. I'm suggesting we're teaching too much mathematics to too many people. We're inflicting too much of the subject on people who don't need it, and as a result, we don't use other alternatives, other options.
So what math should we give up?
I would say everybody doesn't have to know calculus. If you're going to become an aeronautical engineer, fine, but most of us aren't. It's a bit like saying everybody should learn Arabic because they may need it someday.
Mm-hmm. And what would you put in its place, if you would?
What I would prefer is, I'm teaching a class at my own college. I call it Numeracy 101. It's really citizen statistics. Statistics for intelligent people like you and me, like the federal budget, corporate reports, police homicide rates. Mm-hmm. Let's figure those numbers out.
Stuff you read in the newspaper, and you can understand that.
Right.
Maria Druzkova, I imagine you disagree with Andrew, considering you teach calculus to five-year-olds.
Hello, everyone. I think we can build on this message. So I'm not going to argue with it. I'm going to expand it. I'm going to ask even more. What mathematics can each child enjoy? Can each grown-up learn? And in the last decades, we discovered or we rediscovered from the past how beautiful and joyful and useful different kinds of advanced mathematics can be to different kinds of diverse people, even young children like I work with little ones. So my proposal is to take this message, make it stronger, but also maybe kinder, make mathematics available, more available, redesign it so it's more accessible to more kinds of people, young children, adults who worry about it, adults who maybe had bad experience. And then instead of forcing people, we will do inviting people to all this beautiful, useful, mm-hmm. and joyful math.
Pam Harris, where do you check in on this?
So I think it's interesting that I think, like Maria, I'm going to add to the argument that what we have in the United States right now is a lot of people not. You said you wanted to do it with pre-calculus, Ira. A lot of people agreeing with you that maybe some of this higher math didn't seem very relevant for them. And it's interesting that the more that I work with parents and teachers and students, that I think I see sort of three ways of looking at math. And because I see these three groups of people kind of looking at what we're talking about differently, we are sometimes talking past each other and not really communicating very well. There's a group of folks who really understand what I call real math, despite the way that we tend to teach it in the United States as a memory-based, mimic the teacher kind of way, that even though teachers taught it that way, they actually constructed relationships in their own head and they used those to solve problems. But there's another group of teachers, actually like myself, when I was growing up, that I heard the message clearly that math was, the definition of math, was that it was a bunch of things to memorize and that I was supposed to mimic the teacher, do all the steps in the right order, and circle the answer. Because we have these different perspectives, I think there's a lot of folks hearing our conversation right now thinking, the way we teach math is fine, I learned it, it's great. But I'm here to tell you, I was in that second group, that what I learned, I call fake math, wasn't math at all. That I was actually very successful with fake math. I got really good grades, I went on, I became a math teacher. But in reality, I had very few mathematical relationships I could draw on to mathematize my world, to quote Kathy Fosno, who's a lovely person who taught me a lot about what math really is, that mathematics is about relationships and connections. And some of the ideas that Maria wants to bring out, these, when she says beautiful and joyful, I think we sometimes talk past each other. If somebody's like I was, they're not hearing beauty and joy in any of that
exactly.
rote memorization.
Andrew, I mean, I my view on some of this is we don't teach art for you to be an artist. We don't teach music for you to be a musician, but we teach you how to appreciate what it does for us and the beauty and where its place is in the world. Maybe we could teach math more like not just knowing how to do the rote stuff, but where it fits in.
Well, mathematics is a sublime human accomplishment. Some would say a discovery, but it is. The question is how much of this we want to inflict on everybody.
But aren't there people who are good at it?
Of course there are, but it's one of the few subjects where we make everybody do 4 full years of it. And there are, let me give you an example on this. Most American adults have studied algebra. And yet when the government did a survey, National Assessment of Educational Progress, they discovered of adults, 82% could not compute the price of a carpet, even when given the dimensions. They've done all that algebra, but they're numerically illiterate. I would say cut back on the trigonometry, the calculus, and let's make ourselves
more practical math.
Practical and as civilized people. Could I give you one example on this in my class? I give the students a 95-page document from the National Center of Health Statistics, which has lots of figures on American deaths. And I say, okay, we're going to talk about Black Lives Matter. What is the ratio of black people killed by police as opposed to white people? Well, the students, long time to figure it out, but they finally came out with a number. Would you care to know? We're the only ones who've discovered it. It's a public statistic. For every 100 people killed by police, white people, 270 black people are killed. Okay.
Yeah. And this is an exercise you give them in actually looking through stuff that's meaningful to them.
Absolutely.
And they see how math is meaningful to them. Maria, did you?
I'd like to add to this that I think this example is interesting and relevant to most people who probably hear it. And I think it should be offered as such. What I hear is a lot of conversation about forcing people to do math, inflicting mathematics on them. I want to really take an issue of that. Why should we inflict any mathematics or force any mathematics on people? We should offer, we should make it available. And some people probably would like different kinds of mathematics. There is very beautiful mathematics in Fibonacci sequence that a lot of people know. When I say that, that curve, the spiral, a lot of artistically minded people would want that. In our upcoming book, Avoid Hard Work, ironically, we talk a lot about Jan problem solving, where we do a lot of storytelling mathematics, where ideas from, well, advanced mathematics are made very, very accessible to young children through stories and pretend play. So some people want that and crave that and would spend a lot of time very willingly doing that.
Well, can you separate the two populations out of people who can, the kids who can understand and want more of that, from people who are never going to understand that stuff?
I think separating population right now where we are has very unfortunate connotations. I am not touching that one with a 10-foot pole, and I do not recommend people even going there. What I do recommend is offering a lot of diverse, beautiful, advanced, concrete, abstract, artistic, poetic mathematics, and making it available and accessible to everybody, and let people be exposed and invited and offered that.
Pam, would you agree with that, Pam?
That's my take on it.
I think that's a great thing for us to shoot for in the future. I'm a little bit more pragmatic at the moment, that I'm really cautious about limiting the opportunities for any student and what they want to do with their life. So when we use an example of, I don't need trigonometry if I'm not going to become some sort of scientist or an engineer or something that needs this higher math, I want to be really careful that we don't limit students' opportunities for things that they may find interesting, but they may not choose it because they don't even know about it yet. But
Pam,
to me,
could I ask you a question on that score?
Of course.
Currently, only about 5% of all occupations, at the very most, require mathematics at the level of algebra above. Only 5%.
You just caught me talking about people's future occupations as if that's the only reason to take mathematics. And I want to back off of that and suggest that this beautiful, sublime activity can be used to influence how we see the world. But I want to go back to my statement that if people right now listening only hear math as that set of memorized things they learned in school, that's not going to make a lot of sense to them. I think we need to give people examples of how we can teach your kind of numeracy that you're promoting. My book, Building Powerful Numeracy, absolutely promotes building powerful numeracy. I want to do it much earlier because that's what math is. Real math.
Don't you have to have teachers who are able to do that, to bring the beauty of math out to students who don't see it? How many teachers, when they're in teaching school or in college or in classrooms, take the time to do that? I mean, aren't they too busy teaching for the tests or the requirements and things
absolute
like that?
Ira on that, one of the chief culprits is the Common Core. I know we're supposed to genuflect before it, but it has such a high level of mathematics that's going to be imposed on everybody in these Common Core tests that teachers are going to have to teach up at that level.
So, Pam, how do you do that? How do you bring that beauty of math that's out there?
It's absolutely possible, but you've got to get teachers who grew up, we have a self-perpetuating system. The teachers that, if they grew up thinking that math is this set of memorized things, and now the standards in the Common Core are actually fairly decent. I don't want to get into the politics of a national curriculum, but the standards themselves don't dictate how we teach, but we can teach what I call real math, not fake math, and still meet those standards. I'm not in favor of the high-stakes testing, especially the time pressure. I think all three of us agree on that. But we can still meet those standards, but teach them in such a way that kids actually own those relationships. And if we have time, I'd love to give you an example.
Well,
give
me an example of you talk about numeracy. Give us an example of how numeracy
Absolutely.
Can teach math.
Certainly. So one of the big conversations often is math facts. The kids need to know their facts. Well, I want students to more than know their facts. Of course, I want them at their fingertips. But if they're not, I want them to have a way to figure them out quickly. My tagline is math is figure outable. So if I have 6 times 7, a most missed fact, a kid's going to miss one, they might miss that. If I'm thinking about 6 sevens and a student doesn't know it, I'd love them to know it. But if they don't, then I might ask them, do you know 3 sevens? And if a kid knows 3 sevens is 21 and I need 6 sevens, then I just need to double 21, which is 42. And so 6 times 7 is 42. But see, now I want that to lead into higher math. So I want to take that understanding that we can chunk these areas together, a 6 by 7, and think about it as 2 3 by 7s, and mm-hmm. think about 60 times 7. Well, then that would be 420. And if I know 60 sevens is 420, then can I think about 59 sevens?
I get it.
That would be one less 7. Now, hang on, because let me go into Maria's calculus. Now that I'm chunking these areas together, now I'm building this big idea that I can find the area of a really complicated figure by looking at the areas of composite figures. And then I can look at infinity to make those really tiny and look at lots of them. And that's a huge idea in calculus. So I also would like to make that available at a much younger age so that when students reach these higher math topics, we're not inflicting anything. They're finding the beauty in it because we've allowed them to construct those relationships.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about math in school with Andrew Hacker, author of The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions. Maria Druzhkova, a mathematician and founder of the company Natural Math based out of Raleigh. Pamela Weber-Harris, lecturer at the University of Texas and Austin, and author of Building Powerful Numeracy. Let's see if we can go to the phones and get some questions here from some of our listeners, because a lot of questions here. Everybody wants to talk. Well, let's go to Casey. And is it Bettendorf, Iowa?
That's right. Okay. I'm reminded when your second panelist started talking about teaching, sort of trying to engage different types of students in different ways. Sort of the best teacher, scientific teacher, specifically that I ever heard of was Richard Feynman, who said, you know, you have to basically be chaotic and teach all kinds of different ways and all kinds of different angles. So you're engaging one, you know, when one student is maybe getting bored, another is being engaged. And when that person gets engaged, maybe the other person gets bored, but you're doing it from a lot of different angles. And I think it's important to give kids at least a certain number of tools to put in their toolbox, so that no matter where they go, they can do a certain number of, things they might be asked to do, calculate the volume of a sphere.
I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to drop you. Andrew, what do you say to that? Can we give them different ways to?
I'm going to leave it to those who are in mathematics to work out the ways to make their subject interesting and exciting so students will want to take it. All I ask is that alternatives, other options be offered instead of putting all of us on the road to calculus.
Mm-hmm. Maria, before we go, I want to know how you teach calculus to 5-year-olds. How does that work?
I'll use my favorite example and I'll build on what Pamela said. So let's imagine a box of Lego blocks, just regular ones you play with. And a lot of children these days love Star Wars. So when I say, let's imagine Millennium Falcon, the Millennium Falcon, everybody can imagine it's a complex shape, but still people have it in their mind. So just build it out of Lego blocks. Well, why did we do that? It's very similar to the idea of integration. You build complex shape out of simple shape. And now we can ask mathematical questions. How many blocks did it take? It's a rough estimate, especially that Starship has the round part. How mm-hmm. do you build a circle out of squares? And if you use smaller blocks, can you make a better circle? Will it be a better shape? What will change with the area of volume? You can do all these very simple, very fun questions because everybody likes to build starships with very little children, and they enjoy it very much. And it leads them to ideas like integration and limits, because integration is just making complex shapes out of simple shapes.
There you have it.
And
sounds like a lot of fun, too, for the kids.
It's a lot of joy. And one more point I want to make
quickly
about what you said earlier, quickly, about grown-ups.
We'll have to get to it later. It's such an interesting topic. We'll come back to it. Andrew Hacker, author of the book The Math Myth, Other STEM Delusions. Pamela Weber-Harris, author of Building Power Numeracy. Maria Druzhkova, mathematician and founder of the company Natural Math. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Have you ever looked at your hand, your five fingers, and thought that it must be an evolutionary descendant of all those long, tiny bones at the end of a fish's pectoral fins? Up till now, many scientists have said no. The bones even form through different processes during development. Can't be the same thing. But new research from the University of Chicago says actually there may be an evolutionary link after all. Here to explain it, Dr. Kim Cooper, Assistant Professor of Biological Sciences, University of California, San Diego. She looks at the evolution and development of bones in other animals and wrote a commentary about the research in Chicago. Kimberly Cooper, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
Hey there. Let's go back a little bit and talk about what we used to think. Why wouldn't fins and hands be related? You know, you look at them and they look like, hey, they should be related.
So superficially, they look related because both have long bones that are oriented away from the body. But actually, the skeleton of our limbs develops entirely differently. It forms in the embryo on a cartilage scaffold that is then replaced by bone, whereas in the fish fin, those long, skinny bones are actually directly formed by ossification in the skin itself.
Hmm. So this new research found that there really is a connection.
So there is, right. So we've known for a long time that the arm, the upper and lower arm bones, were similar to other bones that are in the fish's fin. But we long thought that those long, skinny bones were lost in the common ancestor, leading to the lineage to humans, and that the hand was this novel structure. And so what they found is that if you think about building a building, instead of going and buying all new construction materials to make a hand, you've gone to the salvage yard and taken some of the information that was there in the fish to make a hand by similar processes.
Hmm. So that's kind of exciting, kind of shocking.
It is. It was really surprising because the two structures have a very, very different outcome in the way the bones form.
Mm-hmm. What does this say about the big picture of how mammals evolved and our relationship to modern fish?
It tells us that the early developmental mechanisms that give rise to the structures of our skeleton, of our hand, if you look at a fish, the cells and the genes that make those long, skinny bones in the fish were repurposed to make our own hands. So it makes me look at fish a lot differently.
Mm-hmm. And the discovery that there might be a common gene for both of them.
Yes. Yeah. So the Hox
Tell
genes
us about
are
that.
Known. Right. So the Hox genes are known to give segments throughout the body identity. And some of these Hox genes are expressed in our hands. And in mice, if you mutate these Hox genes, then the mice don't have hands. And nobody had actually done the Hox mutation in fish before because there are more of the genes that you would have to mutate. But with the CRISPR-Cas9 technology that lets you edit a genome very rapidly, the Shubin lab was able to eliminate the three Hox genes that they were interested in. And they found surprisingly that just like in the mouse that is missing its hand, the fish fin has a very, very severely reduced skeleton. So the same genes that are responsible for forming our hand are also responsible for forming this part of the fish fin skeleton that we thought had absolutely no relationship to our hand.
So there's the connection, right?
That is the connection.
In the genes.
Right, exactly.
Did something happen along the way? I mean, just thinking out loud there, if we change the gene in our bodies, could we make it into a fish fin or vice versa?
The way that they did the experiment, actually, it was very interesting because the fish have these Hox genes that we have, but they don't actually have the regulatory sequence that expresses that gene in fingers. Hmm. And so what they did is they took that regulatory sequence and they put it into the fish, and that's what they used to permanently mark cells that gave rise to those long, skinny bones. And so what is interesting is where did those regulatory sequences come from? How did the cells managed to develop a new program to turn those cells into fingers instead of turning them into fins.
So what does this say about the bigger picture of how mammals evolved in our relationship to modern fish?
It tells us where our hand came from, but the lineage to mammals has been elaborated even further by evolution. So if you look at, this is one of the things that my lab is really interested in. If you look at many, many species of mammals, you'll see that like bats have wings and horses have a single toe and dolphins have flippers. And we study this little bipedal rodent that has a very dramatically changed hind limb that lets it jump around. And so the work by the Shubin lab tells us where the hand came from, and then other mechanisms elaborated that structure to give us the great diversity and form that you see today.
Wow. So where do you go from here?
What's
the next research question you want to answer?
Well, the next research question that my lab wants to answer, or the follow-up of the Shubin paper?
Take your pick.
Right, okay. So the next research question that my lab wants to answer is to try to understand how the integrated musculoskeletal system of the limb is shaped by the genome.
Hmm.
What are the changes in the DNA sequences that deploy genes in different ways to give you different shapes of the limb? And so specifically, we're interested in scaling of the digits.
Yeah.
So in the Shubin work, they're showing where the digits came from, and we're interested in seeing how those digits get reshaped by rewriting the information, how evolution has rewritten the information in the genome to do that.
Wow, sounds fascinating. You'll have it figured out by Monday, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm going to just work all weekend.
Thank you, Dr. Cooper. Nice to have you.
Good thing is that evolution gives us job security.
Stay with us, because I want to bring on another guest. I want to turn to another interesting question in the studies of limbs, which is why don't our fingers or our hands or our legs grow back? When we lose them, other animals grow back their limbs. Why can't we? Dr. David Gardner is professor of developmental and cell biology at the University of California at Irvine, and he is a specialist in the axolotls, a salamander that's nearly extinct in the wild but much studied in labs, because when you cut off one of their limbs, it grows back. And there's a great video on our website showing this process in action. It's amazing, and explaining how it works, and you can visit it, that video at sciencefriday.com/limbs. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Gardner.
Great to be here, Ira.
So how does axolotl get its sort of magical properties? You can actually cut it off a leg and it just grows right back.
Lots of animals can regenerate. We regenerate really well. We don't, if you cut off an arm, it doesn't grow back. But all the bits and pieces, of the arm pretty much regenerate really well. That's what keeps us going. So I think the question would be more like, why, since everybody else can do it, why don't we? And there must be some selection against us regenerating the way an axolotl does.
And how would you answer that question?
If I knew the answer to that, we'd be regenerating arms and legs right now.
But
I think, it goes back to the evolution question. So I really enjoyed the comments that Kim had to make, because I think it's important to realize that, when we look around and see all these animals and plants and life forms on Earth, they have evolved for hundreds of millions and billions of years. And so these experiments have been going on. And so you look at an axolotl and it shows you that the mechanisms are there to regenerate it, and they have discovered how to do it. So the answer is, tease that apart experimentally and figure out what the steps are. And then once you know the steps, then we should be able to do that in humans, walk through step by step that gives you the outcome of regeneration.
But you did that, and that's what's so fascinating about this video. You did that with the axolotl. You actually had it grow a third limb by cutting out just a section of one of the arms, and then tell us, I'll let you tell us how you did that.
Well, it goes back to the basic idea is that in response to injury. So injury starts it all. Then there's going to be a sequence of events. And this is going to happen, and then the next thing will trigger that, and then that'll trigger. So it's stepwise. It's step by step. And the question is, what are those steps and what are the choices? And somewhere along that process of making those choices, axolotls make a choice that we don't. So
I want you to get into the exact method because it's fascinating of how you.
Oh, the method itself.
Yeah,
I teach this in one of my classes, and it's really complicated.
Okay. So what it does is what we call a gain of function approach. So you make a wound, and the wound heals. That's all it's going to do because it doesn't it can't progress to the next step. So you make a wound, and we know you need signals from nerves, and we now understand what those signals are. And you do that by making the wound and then deviating the nerve. And it starts down this pathway to regenerate, but it's missing one last piece, which is what the information is to tell it what to make. And in this case, it's to make the hand. So you need information that says, you know, here's the information for the thumb, and here's the information for the little finger. And then the system, once you give it that information, it can fill in and it makes all the missing pieces in between.
So
then you end up with an animal with an extra arm.
So you sort of leave a space where the arm should be and the two parts on both sides of that space talk to each other and figure out how to grow the arm that needs to be there.
Right.
Wow.
That's pretty much, you just said it. Because you said a lot in there, which is there's information, the cells have the information, and the cells have the ability to talk to each other. And we understand that now. That's the core of modern biology is how cells talk to each other and how they use that information. And they use that to control where they go. So they migrate, they proliferate, and then eventually they make things, they differentiate. And that's all controlled by cells talking to each other.
But what we don't yet know is why human cells can't do the same thing, right? Do we know if the positional information is missing from humans or if the human cells just don't even know that their neighbor is not the right thing to be able to fill in that gap?
Yeah, right. I mean, and that's the challenge. I think the evidence is that the information is there. I mean, there are, you know, a lot now of sequencing, you know, gene sequencing experiments. And so the Hox genes, for example, you know, those are very stable properties, and they are very positionally expressed in humans. So that we're seeing that maybe the information is there. I would point out that you can't. It's very difficult to distinguish between stimulation and disinhibition. So we keep thinking, well, why can't humans regenerate, but the other possibility is that we do regenerate, but it's being repressed.
Uh-huh.
So we're looking for repressors. So because there's so much regeneration everywhere in the animal world.
I get you. We have to regenerate our ID here. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with David Gardner and Kimberly Cooper. So this is $64 question: is how do how to make humans do what these other animals can do, Kimberly? Right.
It is. It definitely is. And if you look at evolution of regeneration, we do know that it was a loss in species that can't regenerate, and not something that's special about an axolotl, for example.
But the fact that we can regrow, put limbs back when people lose them in an accident, we can put them back together, does that give us any knowledge about how it might work?
You mean in wound healing,
yeah,
and repair?
Yeah. I mean,
I'll let David answer that question.
Yeah. One of the important things, I mean, this is relevant today. The important thing about regeneration is restoring the function.
Yeah.
And so one way to do that is to replace the structure. But what is happening right now with regenerative engineering, you know, people are trying to move in that direction by, you know, changing the result of wound healing to give you a more functional outcome. And one of these days, you know, I'm confident that we will regenerate that we have this endogenous ability. That could be
so
a long way
we
to
do
play,
to
we're seeing this already.
We do to some extent. So if you back up in development, up to about six years of age, you can cut off the end of a finger. I don't encourage anyone to do this. I actually have a new baby, and I made a joke to a nurse about this, who didn't appreciate it. But if an infant or a young child loses the end of their finger, including bone, it'll actually grow back and replace the fingerprint.
That happens in adults too. It just doesn't happen quite as well.
I mean, it doesn't happen as well in
young kids, you know. But in adults, we do see, and people have studied that extensively in the mouse model, how digit tips regenerate. And the answer seems it's what one would expect, that these are signaling pathways that are used over and over again in development. They're reused in regeneration. So these are growth factors, morphogens that, you know, play really important roles in development, but then they get reactivated. And that's what a salamander seems to be able to do. It seems to be able to go back and reactivate those early embryonic patterns and do it again.
Okay.
It also doesn't do one thing that we do, which is form massive scarring. So in an adult human, if you induce a really bad injury, you get this really dense extracellular matrix that forms a gnarly scar, and it's hard to rebuild from
that. We'll have to leave it at that. David Gardner, Professor of Developmental and Cell Biology at UC Irvine, Kimberly Cooper, Assistant Professor of Biological Sciences, University of California in San Diego. And really, check out this axolotl limb regeneration video online at sciencefriday.com/limbs. One last thing before we go. Last weekend, we got news of the passing of D.A. Henderson, a giant in the field of public health. Dr. Henderson spoke with me in 2009 about smallpox, historically so deadly it became a cultural icon.
At one time, smallpox was present worldwide, every country. Whether you were in the tropics or way up north, you would eventually encounter smallpox. And so as you go back through history, you will find that there are gods and goddesses in many different cultures for smallpox. It's the only disease for which there are gods and goddesses. And this was true in Japan and China and India and Africa.
Dr. Henderson had led the effort to rid the world of smallpox. And in 1980, the World Health Assembly declared smallpox to be eradicated, the only infectious disease to achieve this distinction. D.A. Henderson died last Friday at the age of 87. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alex Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.